"Want to come ashore for a brief excursion?" Ethan asked. Charlie was perched on the bed in her small cabin, going through D.C. area housing brochures with Alexi and Clara. Alexi and Jude were set. Jude had snagged a great rent-to-own property near the crew offices in Northern Virginia. Clara and Thor were in a short-term rental, but looking for something more permanent. Clara had told Charlie it was actually a difficult search because everyone kept trying to make it so easy.
There are about 35 agents working out of the office now, not to mention the tech department, and they're all giving Thor leads, which makes for dozens of places for us to look at. Thing is, we have to have space, and I'd like a yard. We have a husky.
Charlie had just laughed at that. Of course they had a husky. Thor was from Alaska. Then Ethan had knocked and identified himself, and they'd opened the door. Charlie felt as if they were being a bit overcautious, but plenty of people were killed in broad daylight, so there was no point taking chances. Charlie was curious as to where he wanted to take her. They were docked at Oak Alley, which she'd seen plenty of times before, but the truth was that she would be happy to go anywhere with him, so she said,
"Sure."
"We'll be back in an hour or so. Plenty of time for you to set up for tonight's show," Ethan said, adding quietly, "We're going to see Shelley Corley."
"Poor woman," Alexi said. "First she lost a cousin, and then she lost a fiancé."
Ethan nodded.
"We'll be as sensitive as possible, but the truth is, when you've lost someone you love, you do want justice for them."
"I worry about myself. I think I might flat out want vengeance," Alexi said. "Not nice, not right, but true."
After a quick promise to see them and plenty of time to get set up to greet the early dinner seating, Charlie joined Ethan and they left the ship. On shore, she saw a woman standing beside a Chevy sedan. Ethan must have told her whom to look for because she waved as soon as she saw them. Shelley Corley was about 50, and was also one of the most attractive women Charlie had ever seen. Her skin was a beautiful café au lait color, her hair was dark, and her eyes were a true amber. She was dressed in a pale blue business suit and a large sun hat in a matching shade. Her features were strong and arresting, and though she smiled as she greeted them and shook hands, her smile was grim.
"When Special Agent Crow spoke with me this morning, well, I realized immediately I needed to speak with you. I want to help in any way possible. There's a small place down the road where we can talk, past Oak Alley and just on the other side of Law Plantation."
"I think I know the place you're talking about," Ethan said. "Thank you for picking us up."
Shelley nodded and got into her car. Charlie immediately took the back seat, allowing Ethan the front. As they drove, they discussed the journey, the historic plantations they would be passing, even the weather. Once they were seated inside the small mom-and-pop coffee shop that was their destination, Shelley quickly went into high gear.
"When Albion was found murdered, I thought my heart broken too," she said. "Then when Pharaoh was killed, well, I felt like whatever was left of my heart had been shattered completely. I don't say that for pity, because I'm strong, and I'm gonna be fine. Albion had never married, and he had no children of his own, but I'm a widow. I went back to my maiden name, and I have two daughters. They both live in California now, but they came home quickly to be with me. And I have cousins and nephews and nieces, friends. I'm surrounded by those who love me. I don't need anyone's pity."
"I would never offer pity, but you do have my deepest sympathy," Ethan said. "I have to ask, though, did anyone else know about you and Pharaoh?"
"Well,"
Shelley said, looking toward Charlie.
"Your father knew, of course,"
she turned back to Ethan.
"But otherwise, no. I hadn't even told my daughters. When Albion was killed, I had to wonder if it was a hate crime. But when Pharaoh was killed, too, I didn't see how it could be. Now, what I believe is that they somehow crossed someone.
She turned to Charlie again and reached for her hand.
You found Farrell,
she said softly.
Yes,
Charlie said.
Thank you. Otherwise, he might have lain there for a very long time. I'm just hoping that finding him sooner was also better, that it'll make it easier to catch the killer,
Charlie said. Shelley nodded.
I just know whoever did it, he didn't do it because of Farrell and me. And I can't believe one of our friends would have had anything against Farrell or Albion. Our friends are professors, musicians, actors, and painters, all professions that tend to skew very liberal.
She paused for a moment.
You have to understand, they were both good men. I can't think of anything they were involved in that would upset anybody, especially not upsetting them enough to commit murder.
She sighed.
I honestly have no clue why they were targeted, but I brought you a list of the causes they were involved with, names and addresses and everything.
This is going to be very helpful, Ms. Corley. I can't thank you enough, Ethan told her. She smiled.
You're welcome. I didn't know what else to do. I called the police and asked about Albion's body because I need to plan his funeral. They're not releasing him yet, though. Or Farrell. With Farrell, well, I'll be attending that funeral, naturally. But his son will be planning it, and his body won't be released to me.
I'm so sorry, Charlie murmured.
As I said, I'm fine. I have a great support system. But thank you. Just find out who killed them. And don't worry, I'm not gonna go to the police. If I did, they'd just start questioning my family or Farrell's son. And if there's one thing I'm certain of, it's that no one in our families did this.
Shelley's certainty reminded Charlie of her own certainty of her father's innocence. Suddenly, Shelley turned to her.
I know it must be difficult to talk about, so I apologize for asking, but how did you find Farrell, Miss Monroe?
Charlie was taken by surprise.
We had been filming in the area. I was looking for missing props.
Shelley studied her, as if trying to decide whether to believe her explanation or not. Finally, she smiled.
You're a lovely young woman, and I'm so sorry for what you've been through here. And your father's a fine man. I never knew him well, but I know my cousin and Farrell thought very highly of him.
Thank you, Charlie said, and smiled herself.
I rather like him myself. Albion said your mom has been gone a while.
Yes.
But her family, so they say, had a feel for the dead.
Charlie looked at Ethan. He shrugged to let her know she didn't have to answer. But before she had a chance to even think of how to answer, Shelley spoke again.
Has either of them, Farrell or Albion, spoken to you? Come to you and say a dream?
I'm so sorry. No, Charlie said, and glanced at Ethan again.
If they do,
Shelley whispered.
Will you listen?
Of course, Charlie promised. Ethan? Shelley turned and looked at Ethan.
So that's how it is. They speak to you, too. I guess what they say is true. Your unit is special. The crew of hunters. Isn't that what they call you? I googled some of their past cases. I doubted any government agency would go beyond the obvious, but I seem to have been wrong. And that gives me hope you'll find the man who killed Farrell and Albion.
We're committed to that, Ethan assured her.
Yes, we are, Charlie said. Shelley patted her hand as if satisfied, then looked at Ethan.
I hope you'll talk to the charities on that list I gave you. There's a no-kill animal shelter, one that focuses on historic preservation, and another that's trying to regulate the number of oil rigs in the Gulf. Even one dedicated to saving a single historic church in Baton Rouge. I hope you meant it when you said the list'll help you.
It will, Ms. Corley, Ethan told her. You can count on it.
Please, call me anytime you need me.
she said, producing cards and handing one to each of them.
I teach piano and voice, so you shouldn't have any trouble reaching me.
She studied Charlie again.
If one of them is still here in spirit form, Ms. Moreau, he'll find you, if you let him.
Charlie nodded.
I hope so, Ms. Corley.
She wasn't just saying the words either. She really did hope. She was accustomed to seeing the dead, and both Farrell and Albion had been good men. She hoped they'd both found peace, but if one of them did appear to her, it would only be to help, and that could only be a positive thing. And yet a strange fear filled her. She remembered being a small child, holding her father's hand by the church, seeing several men walking around in their uniforms. Men no one else saw, except her father. He had known she was seeing the dead, and he had told her,
"Fear the living, Charlie, because the living are the only ones who can hurt you."
She had understood then, and she still considered those words to live by. Someone out there had killed 3 people, and that person was still out there. She looked at Ethan and caught him studying her. She tried to smile back at him as they left the little cafe, his arm lying comfortable across her shoulders. She couldn't help but wonder if he'd felt the same strange twist of fear. 13. Ethan met with Thor Erickson and Jude McCoy at 4:30, while the Southern Bells went into their preparation mode for the evening. Thor told him he'd enjoyed seeing Oak Alley, along with the trip next door to Laura, a Creole plantation, in contrast to an English plantation. Jonathan Moreau had left the house's tours to the on-site guides, and Thor had enjoyed listening to them as much as he'd enjoyed listening to Jonathan. He hadn't learned anything useful, but on the plus side, nothing bad had happened to Jonathan. Ethan was glad that Charlie hadn't realized yet that her father might be in danger. He was glad nothing had happened, and that Thor had enjoyed listening to Jonathan. In turn, Ethan shared the conversation he'd had with Shelley. He'd already emailed them the list she'd given him of the various charitable groups Albion and Farrell had worked with. He'd also sent the list off to Angela at headquarters so she could use the Bureau's more powerful databases and resources. For boots-on-the-ground investigation, he'd divided up the list, and they would each take responsibility for a few. Thor and Ethan were going to check into an organization called Doggone It, which was dedicated to turning every shelter in the country into a no-kill facility. They happened to have an office in Natchez, so they could drop in the following day. The two of them were also going to tackle Sane Energy, an organization that fought to regulate where and when oil rigs were set up in the Gulf, and what kind of piping was allowed to be laid along the riverfront. Their head office was in Vicksburg, the next stop after Natchez. Jude would watch over the Southern Bells and see what he could learn from the crew. Dinner time rolled around, and Alexi, Claire, and Charlie began their second night set. That night, after the opening medley, they began the unique part of the set list with a little-known ballad, "My Love in My Arms to Move No More." Jonathan joined them as the meal was served, and he watched the women with a look of pride and pleasure on his face. Charlie told a story that night about 2 men who had been friends but had served on opposite sides during the war. The Union soldier had been badly injured and left for dead on the battlefield. His friend found him, but rather than let him be taken prisoner, he took the chance of being shot as a traitor himself and spirited the wounded man to the home of another old friend, a Confederate who had already lost his only son in the war. A physician, he saved the life of the Union soldier and hid him until the war's end. Charlie ended by telling the rapt audience where to look to find more information on the men and their lives. As she finished, she looked over at Jonathan, since storytelling, especially historical storytelling, was his forte. He smiled broadly and nodded his approval, and Charlie smiled back. Ethan could tell how much it mattered to her that she had pleased her father. Just as the performance was ending, his cell phone vibrated in his pocket. He excused himself and headed out on deck to answer. It was Randy Lorenz.
"I'm getting nowhere here," Randy said. "I hope you're having better luck."
"Nothing yet," Ethan told him, which wasn't really a lie since he didn't have anything solid. He told Randy he was planning to investigate the various groups Corley and Hickory had been involved with.
"All quiet there? No other
murders?" Randy asked him dryly.
"No, thank God."
"Keep me posted."
"Will do. And you do the same, please."
"You got it." They rang off, and Ethan headed back toward the dining room. He arrived just in time for the final song, but as he entered, he felt something shift in the atmosphere. A smoky mist seemed to sift into the Eagle View dining room. The living diners were still there, but now they had been joined by the dead. Soldiers in tattered uniforms of blue and gray and butternut, identified by the insignias of the infantry, cavalry, artillery, and the navy. They were heedless, then, of the living, except for an occasional shiver as a server moved through one of them. They were staring at the small raised stage, completely focused on Charlie as she sang another mournful ballad. He stayed where he was, standing in the doorway. He noticed one man in particular who had hunkered down right in front of Charlie. The ghost wore a shirt with rolled-up sleeves, a vest, and an apron smeared with blood. He was, Ethan thought, a doctor. The doctor who had acknowledged Charlie before, the ghost she'd talked about. Ethan's heart felt heavy in his chest as he looked out over the room. On the one hand, he was sorry for the burden the men carried. On the other, he was touched to see that none of them seemed to be aware whether they were north or south, that they should be enemies. In this room, they were just men, injured, ill, and possibly dying soon, aware only that they'd left families behind, loved ones they might never see again. Charlie finished the song. Applause erupted. The mist faded away. And with it went the dead who had filled the room only moments before. Except for one. The doctor. Ethan wished that he could keep the living from moving, from talking. They'd already driven the other ghosts away, and he found himself striding forward, wondering if he couldn't somehow reach the doctor, urge him to stay. Too late. The bells were bowing, and the diners were rising, filing out. He couldn't reach the doctor quickly enough. But he could see Charlie. She smiled and waved to the audience, then walked toward the doctor, her hand outstretched. The doctor, too, reached out, touched her hand. And then he was gone, and Charlie was reaching out to nothing more than air. Charlie had to wonder if it was wrong of her to find moments of such deep pleasure and happiness when three people had been murdered and their killer was still out there somewhere. But she couldn't help herself. Ethan was back, and they were together, just as she'd hoped they would be all those years ago. It was as if a decade had never separated them. Their connection was something deep and rich, something that had played in their minds throughout the years, something stronger than anything they'd actually shared all those years ago. Of course, theirs had been a strange relationship back then. They had known one another, but they had been 3 years apart, a vast gulf at the time, because he'd been legal age, a college man, and she had still been in high school, nowhere near her 18th birthday. But after the events in the graveyard, there had been hours spent with the police, a lot of time when they'd waited, alone, together, to give another statement to yet another officer or the prosecuting attorney. There had been another bond between them, too. They had both seen the ghost of the Confederate cavalry officer. They both saw the dead, and sometimes even communicated with them. There hadn't been anything sexual between them. Not that she hadn't tried, and yet it still seemed to her she'd never shared a more intimate relationship with anyone than she'd shared with him that night. And now? It was heavenly to lie with him, sleep with him, touch him, tease, laugh, to be naked next to the heat of his body, slip a hand over his flesh and feel him grow instantly aroused as he turned to her, to make love as naturally as if they'd been together forever. There were things he did that shouldn't have been so erotic, so suggestive. The way he kissed and teased her fingertips with his lips and tongue. The way he placed a kiss behind her ear, then trailed more kisses down her nape. Then there were the other incredible things he did, things that were so extremely intimate she could hardly think of them without feeling herself flush with heat, so far beyond seductive that she could scarcely breathe as he did them. And there was just lying there beside him, feeling him breathe, hearing the sound of his heartbeat. But the murders continually hovered over them, and late that night, as they lay together, cooling and sated, he turned to her. "You're pretty close to Jimmy Smith, huh?" he said. There was nothing accusing in his question, no jealousy in his tone, just curiosity.
"I am.
He's kind of like the brother I never had." "Never more than that?" Again, there was no jealousy or accusation in his tone. She had the sense he just felt he needed to know. 10 years had passed. Others had come and gone in their lives. This was almost like a fact-finding mission, but only the future truly mattered.
"No, it was never anything more. We were both only kids, so that drew us together. And he was a member of the Gargoyles, the boys' organization that was like a brother club to that stupid cherub thing I was going to join years ago, that I was pledging for that night," she told him, turning to look into his eyes. "We went to Tulane together, too. Our last year's school, he was one of 5 roommates I lived with. We all pooled our resources to rent a big old place in the Garden District." She frowned, suddenly worried about his question.
"You don't think that Jimmy Smith could be involved?"
"Wait, you do? You're convinced that the film crew had something to do with the murders?"
"I don't particularly suspect Jimmy, but yes, you know I'm investigating the film crew."
"Shelley thinks it's someone involved with one of the organizations Corley and Hickory were involved with. That's what she seemed to be saying anyway."
"I know."
"Trust me, Jimmy is innocent. He's a great guy."
She hesitated.
"He was with the group who tied me to the tombstone that night, but he kept trying to talk the others into letting me go. And after everything, after the police, after the trial, after everything that went on, he spent years apologizing to me. He even quit the club he was in. He said they were nothing but a bunch of jerks."
"People grow up. They see how tough life is, they change."
"We all change.
And yes, most of us get tougher. But we don't suddenly become homicidal. Certainly not Jimmy," she said. He was quiet. She could sense that he wasn't convinced, but simply didn't want to argue with her, and that scared her. Not that she could entirely blame him. If someone didn't know Jimmy the way she did, he might well look like a viable suspect.
"You don't know Jimmy. He could never murder anyone," she said with complete certainty.
He propped himself up on an elbow and looked at her seriously.
"Okay, so it's not your father. We agree on that, although he lied, and there are factors that point in his direction, to the point that I guess the police probably still consider him a suspect. So, who? For the sake of argument, let's say it is someone working on the film." He put up a hand to stop her when she started to protest. "Though I can't be absolutely positive, I tend to put Brad and Mike Thornton in the innocent pool. Certainly neither one of them threw a knife at you because they were both with me. Though, of course, either one of them could have conspired with someone else. We never found the knife, and no prop knives are missing, as far as we know. That would leave Jenny McPherson."
"Jenny, You can't be serious.
Unlikely, I agree. Then there are the tech guys, George, Luke, Barry, and then the actors and extras, Harry and Blaine, Grant. So you tell me, which one of them do you think might be involved?
None of them, Charlie protested. It's someone else. It's gotta be. You really do think it's someone from the film, don't you? Why? Why are you so sure?
No reason, other than proximity and logic, he said in a flat tone. Charlie, the bayonet that killed the men was most likely the one that disappeared from props. The same is probably true of the knife that was thrown at you, he explained. We know people from the film were closer to both Corley and Hickory than they wanted to admit. And we know people other than Hickory were in some kind of a confrontation with Albion Corley on the journey before he was killed. And yes, we know about Shelley now, too. And I'm not forgetting that both men were heavily involved in charities and environmental issues.
So that could point to someone else, Charlie suggested. You don't understand what it's like in the movie business. People are focused on their own careers, and that's their only interest.
Charlie, I don't care what anyone does for a living, or even if being an actor becomes not just what someone does, but who that someone is. There's always another interest out there. And when someone isn't batshit crazy, my own term, by the way, nothing official, the motive generally comes down to love, hate, or money. Sure, there's spur-of-the-moment murder carried out in a fit of emotion, but these murders were planned carefully. We have to find out why. And I'm sorry, but what evidence we have so far points to it being someone you know. She nodded slowly and rose.
Natchez,
she said simply.
See what you find out in Natchez.
And then she headed into the bathroom to shower and get ready for the day. She felt awkward, as if they'd just had their first argument as a real couple. He followed her. In a few minutes, she felt the argument was over. Yes, definitely. They were very good at making up. Ethan stood on the dock with Thor, listening as Jonathan talked about the excursion he would be leading later that day. There were numerous shore excursions on offer, but he would be taking a group to explore several of the various nearby Civil War sites, as well as the city of Natchez itself. Once he had finished and the buses were loaded, Ethan and Jude would head into town and the offices of Doggone It.
Natchez is the county seat of and only major city in Adams County, Mississippi,
Jonathan said, his deep, rich voice commanding attention without trying.
She sits nice and high on the bluff, as you can see. Natchez is 90 miles south of the Mississippi state capital of Jackson and 85 miles north of Baton Rouge. At one time, Natchez was both the capital of Mississippi and one of the most important cities in the South. The local planters engineered new breeds of cotton, and at one point she had the highest per capita income of any city in the United States, pre-Civil War, of course. The French established Fort Rosalie in 1716, and the area became known as the Natchez Colony, named for the Native American tribe that lived in the area. History is rarely peaceful, however, and many French colonists were slain by the Natchez tribe, and vice versa. After the 7 Years' War, the French ceded the colony to the British. Meanwhile, other local tribes took in the remnants of the Natchez, though today their descendants have reorganized under the Natchez name. So, French, British, and then Spanish-American. This is because a treaty gave it to America, but the Spanish had helped the Americans and they had their fingers in the pie, trying to keep control as long as they could. Eventually, the Americans gained the upper hand, but today visitors to the city are greeted by a uniquely charming combination of Spanish, French, British, and American architecture and culture. But I'm skipping ahead. In the 19th century, Natchez flourished with her share of great plantations, just as there are throughout the South.
But as I explained yesterday, everyone knew control of the river was crucial once the Civil War began. New Orleans fell in 1862, and Natchez surrendered soon after, thus sparing herself the destruction of war and ensuring the safety of so much of what you'll see today. I've just simplified about 300 years of history, but I'll go into more depth as the day goes on.
Jonathan looked straight at Ethan as he directed his people to their buses. Ethan met his eyes in return, and Jonathan nodded, as if to say he felt free to do his job, knowing they were on the job as well. Thor had called ahead for a rental car, and it was waiting for them as they went ashore.
"You drive," he said, tossing Ethan the keys. "I'm from the land of ice and snow. Driving in all this heat might be the death of me."
Ethan grinned as he caught the keys in midair. Thor was not only smart, he was the size of a Norse god. Definitely a good man to have at his back. They heard their destination before they saw it. Doggone It was located on several acres just beyond the city limits. The bays, howls, yips, and barks of what Ethan estimated to be a couple hundred dogs filled the air as they neared the compound.
"I've got to commend the group's dedication," Thor said. "No animal will be destroyed. It's a hell of a good goal."
They entered a tiled and absolutely spotless reception area and were greeted by a young woman with the words, "Catherine, Doggone It dog-loving volunteer," embroidered on the pocket of her shirt. She ushered them into an office for their scheduled meeting with William C. Hayworth, director of the charity. Hayworth shook their hands and offered them seats in front of his desk. The man's office was filled with pictures of dogs, all kinds of dogs, posing with the volunteers who had helped them back to health or into forever homes.
"This is a great cause," Thor told Hayworth.
The man beamed.
"Thank you. I understand this visit isn't social, that it has something to do with Mr. Hickory and Mr. Corley, so how can I help you? They were wonderful men, a big part of the work we do here. I admit I'm more than a little curious as to why you're enjoying a Mississippi cruise instead of scouring every street in St. Francisville for clues."
"The parish has an excellent detective handling the investigation there," Ethan said. "Detective Randall Loren. He's following every local lead, but because we suspect that the men were killed because of something to do with the many interests and activities they shared, that means we need to look farther afield than St. Francisville."
"You think their work saving dogs got them killed?" Hayworth asked incredulously.
"Not saving dogs, per se, but maybe doing something in the course of that work that upsets someone else deeply enough to kill them," Thor said.
Hayworth shook his head.
"I know them both well, and I can't think of any reason why someone would have held their work here against them. They were both comfortable financially, but not rich. What made them invaluable to our mission was their energy. Albion Corley encouraged his students to volunteer here, and several have continued their efforts even after graduation. And Hickory, he took in older dogs with not much time left, but who needed some love. They both donated money, of course, but it was their encouragement to others to give both money and effort that helped us the most."
He sighed.
"I just don't see how any of that could have gotten them killed."
"We don't know that it did. We're still investigating all angles. Mr. Corley and Mr. Hickory were involved in a number of causes," Ethan said. "Still, we have to ask. Did you ever see them argue with anyone around here? Do you have any neighbors who are against you having your facility here? Do you know if the victims ever fought with anyone on behalf of this place?"
Hayworth shook his head, clearly at a loss.
"My neighbors are a dairy farm and a fellow who raises goats for cheese. Our dogs have never once gotten out or caused an incident with either one. We are friends. We all belong to the Masonic Lodge together."
Ethan glanced at Thor.
"Are you aware if either Corley or Hickory had any difficulties with anyone at the lodge?" Thor asked.
Hayworth looked annoyed at that, Oh, please, I'm so tired of seeing Masons portrayed as conspiracists and killers in the movies. Neither one was a member of my lodge here. He hesitated, thoughtful. Come to think of it, I did run into both men recently at one of our Walk the Dog for the Dogs functions, and they were pretty upset about something that was going on.
Did you hear the specifics of what they were arguing about? Thor asked.
Hayworth shook his head. They weren't arguing, not with each other anyway. They said they were going to hold firm, and they'd take it as high in the courts as they could go. But what it was about, I don't know. When I asked, Albion just said they'd be happy to fill me in as soon as it was all settled. Ethan asked him if he could remember anything else, but he couldn't, so the agents gave him their cards, telling him to call them directly if he should think of anything. When they were leaving, a slim young woman entered with a huge male husky tugging at the leash while she futilely asked him to heel. She might as well have been asking him to jump over the moon, for all the attention the dog was paying her. He started baying and jumping, nearly taking her down.
"Hey, fella," Thor said,
moving forward, grabbing the leash and rescuing the woman.
"Sit. Sit."
To Ethan's combined surprise and amusement, the dog immediately obeyed.
"Thank you," the woman said. "He's beautiful, but he's so big. I have to bring him back. I just can't keep him."
Hayworth came hurrying out of his office. He looked distressed. "Oh, no," he murmured.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Hayworth. So sorry, but I just can't keep Loki,"
she said. Hayworth looked genuinely distressed.
"Of course, I understand. Loki is... I just don't know what we're gonna do."
He noticed that Ethan and Thor were still there. "This is our third return on Loki. Every time he comes back, it gets harder for us to place him."
"Mr. Hayworth, don't worry. If you can hold on to Loki until we've solved this case and I can head back home, I'll take him," Thor said.
Hayworth looked at him with combined surprise and gratitude.
"You're not just saying that?"
"I'll be back for him, I promise. I'm from Alaska. Huskies are my breed. In fact, if you'd like, I'll be happy to see him back to his kennel, get to know him a little bit more," Thor said.
"Thank you. You have no idea how much of a relief all this is," Hayworth said, then pointed. "This way."
Thor followed him, leading Loki. When they returned, Hayworth was talking away about all Loki's wonderful qualities. Thor met Ethan's eyes and nodded toward the door to indicate that they could leave.
"What are you, a dog whisperer?"
Ethan asked him once they were out of earshot. Thor grinned.
"My sister and her husband raise huskies. I've always been good with them, and I already have one husky at home, so what's one more?" "I'm glad. That's a beautiful dog."
As they reached the car, Ethan turned the conversation back to the case.
"Did Hayworth remember anything more that might help us?" he asked. "I think so," Thor said. "I'm hoping tomorrow will tell us more. There's a lot of oil up my way, so I've seen it before. The constant conflict between energy and the environment. We need energy to live, but we also need to preserve the environment. A lot of people on both sides get heated up about it. But heated up enough to kill? Maybe. A lot depends on money, the way it does for pretty much anything else. So I'm hoping we'll learn more when we get to Vicksburg and talk to the Sane Energy people."
"So how does Hayworth figure into it?"
"While we were walking Loki back, he remembered hearing our Vicks talking more than once about the environment and the river. He said they knew they had to tackle some pretty difficult people on the issue, and they had to get others, including the courts, involved. Hayworth thinks that's what they were talking about at that dog walk thing, and that they were planning on meeting someone in particular who might be able to help them."
"Did he say who?" Thor glanced at him unhappily. "You're not gonna like this," he said. "Jonathan Moreau."
Jude McCoy was sitting in the Eagleview dining room and watching the Southern Bells rehearse their performance for that evening. At first, Charlie thought he must get bored, viewing them day after day. But then she realized that he was getting paid to watch his girlfriend do what she loved, and was probably completely happy with his assignment. He seemed laid back, completely relaxed, as he sat there. But when she looked closely, she could see how aware he was of every move they made and every staff member coming and going through the dining room doors. His watchfulness made her feel safe, and she had to admit, after the incident with the knife, safe was a really good feeling, even though she didn't expect anything to happen aboard ship. When they finished the rehearsal, they headed to lunch. The day was beautiful and, even better, uneventful. Ethan checked in with Jude at one point to say they were heading back and would be there in plenty of time for the second dinner seating. After lunch, Jude and Alexi walked Charlie to her cabin. Jude waited until she was inside, told her to lock the door, and reminded her that they were right next door. Charlie thanked him. She was glad for the escort, but she was also still convinced nothing was going to happen to her while she was aboard the Journey. She'd stepped into the shower when she heard the sound. It was faint, not as if someone was knocking at the bathroom door, but rather as if they were brushing something against it. She turned off the water and listened. The sound had stopped, but unease was racing through her system. She clenched her teeth, picturing her cell phone where it lay on the bed. Mental note, she mocked herself. Remember to bring cell phone into the bathroom next time. There was nothing else, no other sound. She waited, listening, for what seemed like forever. Finally, wrapped in a towel, she drew a deep breath, opened the door, and stepped into the cabin. There was no one there. She wondered what the hell she had heard, or if she had actually heard anything at all. Feeling unnerved and extremely vulnerable in her towel, Charlie dressed quickly. As soon as she had clothes on, she picked up her phone to give Clara a call. Thor was on shore with Ethan, so Clara would be alone too. Charlie felt a bit silly, but even so, she could ask Clara to open the door and watch the hall so she could run the few feet to her friend's cabin. But she never dialed because suddenly she heard the strange brushing sound again, this time against her cabin door. For a few seconds, fear, primal and paralyzing, ripped through her. Pulling herself together, she moved carefully to the door to look out the peephole. And then she saw him. He hadn't knocked because he couldn't knock, and he couldn't knock because he was a ghost. It was the doctor from the dining room. Charlie was sure she didn't really need to open the door for him, but she opened it anyway. He was from a long-ago era. In his day, a man would never enter a lady's cabin without an invitation. Actually, given that she was there alone, he was probably uncomfortable about entering at all. And yet, he'd been around for generations. He must have seen about everything by now. None of that mattered, of course. What mattered was what he could tell her. She quickly opened the door.
"Come in, please," she said.
He entered, and she swiftly closed and locked the door, then indicated the chair at the dressing table.
"Thank you for coming. Please, have a seat."
"Thank you, miss," he said politely.
"I've seen you every night," she told him, taking a seat herself. "I was hoping you would speak with me."
"Yeah," he said softly, a slight crackle in his voice.
He was so quiet that she was certain no one else would be able to hear him, even if they were standing outside in the hall with their ear against the door.
"Two men were murdered," she said. "I believe it either had something to do with the recent reenactment here, or that the killer was aboard that day and maybe even learned something that made him realize murder was his only option."
"They were good men," the doctor said somberly. "Very good men. I watched the reenactment, and I particularly watched them. I was proud of the job they did. That was an important day, but also a hard one.
He appeared to wince.
Apologies for not introducing myself sooner. I'm Captain Ellsworth Daru, Miss, United States Medical Corps. I was aboard when the Johnny Rebs held the boat. They were decent to me and gave me what they had to treat the men. I was proud of the reenactment because it told the story well, and because all those involved that day were good men. Didn't matter what color they wore, or what color they were.
Charlie wasn't sure how to reply.
I'm glad,
she said softly, and also so sorry for all those who died in the war and on this ship.
You have to understand, we all, whichever side we fought on, thought we were patriots.
I do understand, Charlie said. My father...
Your father is Jonathan Moreau. We've watched him many times with a great deal of pride,
Captain Daru said. Charlie smiled.
Thank you.
But I regret to tell you, he is somehow involved in this,
Captain Daru said gravely. Charlie froze. No. She didn't care who tried to tell her that her father was involved. They were wrong. She knew him. He was not a murderer.
He didn't kill anyone,
she said at last, her voice brittle.
No. He is no killer, but he was here on the journey, and they were talking about him, the soon-to-be-dead men, Corley and Hickory. They were trying to figure something out. They kept saying Jonathan will know. They planned to meet with him and ask for his help.
Do you think he's even aware of what he knows?
Charlie asked.
Of how dangerous it seems to be?
That I don't know. But he needs to be careful. Others were nearby when the two men were speaking and might have overheard. Later your father talked with Albion Corley up on the sun deck, and not long afterward the small blonde woman showed up and had an argument with Professor Corley. There were others from the reenactment nearby as well.
Who? Do you know who?
She asked urgently. He shook his head.
I know your father because he's always on the ship. I knew Mr. Hickory and Mr. Corley because I was there when they argued, and your father spoke their names when he stepped in. I don't know the names of any of the others. One couple talked about taking care of their children. Does that help you identify them?
So they were a couple in real life?
Charlie asked, then winced inwardly at the insensitivity of the term. He nodded.
She was about 5½ feet and blonde, and her husband was over 6 feet tall and weighed at least 200 pounds.
She gasped. He just described Nancy and Todd Camp. Charlie reached out. She still hadn't gotten the hang of not doing so, and her hand passed through the tenuous image of his, and yet she was certain that he'd felt the warmth and appreciation in her touch.
Thank you. I need to talk to my father. If he hasn't realized what he knows, maybe I can help him figure it out.
Be careful. I fear for him, just as I fear for you.
She smiled.
I'm safe. I have 3 government agents looking after me, and I think I have you and the others as well.
He nodded gravely.
I wish there was a way to thank you, she said.
He smiled.
Sing, Lorelei,
he told her.
And that duet? Mixing when Johnny comes marching home with Dixie. Please, For all the friends I lost, north and south. For those like me who died of disease, praying for the war to end.
He stood, ready to leave her. She stood as well and said,
Thank you, Captain.
She didn't need to open the door again. He simply dissipated into the air. Charlie sank down on the bed, suddenly weak. She glanced at her watch, anxious now for the excursion in Natchez to be over and for her father to return to the ship. She desperately needed to talk to him. Alone. 14. As they boarded the ship, Ethan called Jude to tell him they were back. Jude assured him that everything was fine. Charlie was in her cabin, next door to his, and he called to check on her not 5 minutes ago. He was about to go get her, then walk her, Alexi, and Clara to the dining room. Ethan briefed Jude on what they had learned and told him that he would wait on deck for Jonathan Moreau to return. He'd been waiting for what felt like hours when the tour buses finally began to pull up by the dock. In a few minutes, he saw Jonathan Moreau, followed by a string of what he could only call fans, approach the ship. Ethan had to give the man credit. He never seemed to notice the admiration in the eyes of his listeners, nor did he pay any extra attention when an attractive woman was especially in awe. His excitement was all for the history he passed on. As he reached the deck, Jonathan noticed Ethan, and Ethan's expression. He excused himself to the group and approached Ethan.
What now? Jonathan asked flatly. You tell me. What are you still not telling us? Ethan said. What are you talking about? Jonathan demanded. If I knew anything, especially since I know my name keeps coming up in your investigation, wouldn't I tell you? Good people have been killed. If I could help in any way, don't you think I would?
I'd like to believe that, yes.
Then what the hell are you talking about?
I'm talking about doggone it, Ethan said. Jonathan stared at him, then shook his head.
What about it? It's an organization promoting no-kill shelters. I sent them a check for $20 every month. How did I hear about it? At my Masonic Lodge. A number of my lodge brothers are into saving animals. People who like to save animals don't usually kill humans, who are animals too, after all.
I was at their headquarters this morning, Ethan said.
I hope you left a healthy check.
I spoke with Mr. Hayworth. Jonathan continued to stare at him, but Ethan simply waited patiently for him to crack and say something.
I don't know the name, Jonathan said. I've never actually visited the place.
All right. How about Sane Energy? Jonathan frowned.
I help them out from time to time, yes?
Doing what?
Trying to get people to talk to one another.
Were Hickory and Corley some of the people who need to talk?
I don't know. Maybe. There's a company called Gideon Oil. Sane Energy has been reaching out to them, hoping to discuss a potential win-win solution. There's several engineers in my lodge who say there's a safer, albeit more expensive, way to lay oil lines along the river from the Gulf of Mexico. There was talk about arranging a sit-down between members of Sane Energy and the management of Gideon Oil.
Why didn't you mention this?
Because it didn't occur to me to mention it. Sane Energy has hundreds of members, and I don't even know anyone at Gideon Oil. I assumed they had someone with better connections setting it up.
Hickory and Corley were passionate about Sane Energy's cause, and word is they intended to use you as a negotiator. He was guessing, of course, but if he sounded definite enough, he might be able to draw out the truth.
If they were, I knew nothing about it. But you can easily find out tomorrow. The head office of Sane Energy is in Vicksburg. Use your badge to make people there talk to you.
Ask them what they know. If Hickory and Corley wanted to involve me, maybe they told the top people at St. Energy. They certainly didn't tell me.
How could you not know if your friends had plans for you?
I'm passionate about one thing, Ethan. History. Other than that, I help out my friends when they ask. But I swear to you, no one had asked me about this. So yes, I lied at first. I lied to you. And God help me, I lied to my daughter. But I did it to protect a confidence. Now you know the truth. And the truth is that both murdered men were my friends, and I would do anything possible to help find their killer. If it has something to do with Gideon Oil, that's news to me. So go to St. Energy tomorrow and...
He broke off, looking at Ethan and shaking his head.
You already planned on going to St. Energy tomorrow, didn't you?
Yes, I did. We did. Jonathan stared at him.
Then excuse me. I'd like to shower and change and go hear my daughter sing.
As Jonathan walked away, Ethan glanced at his watch. The second dinner seating was due to begin shortly. He headed to the Eagle View. She waited until the second seating, but then, as she had promised, Charlie saw to it that they sang both songs Captain Ellsworth Daru had requested. And as she expected, she looked out over the dining room and saw them all, the ghosts of the soldiers who had died so long ago, filling the room. They were like double-exposed film, moving silently among the diners who still lived and breathed. She caught Alexei looking at her, and they exchanged a smile. She realized Alexei understood how much this moment spent singing just for the shades of the dead meant to her. She wasn't sure if happiness was something the dead could still feel, but she had to believe they could, because based on the sense of peace she felt in that moment, she and her friends had indeed made these men happy. She saw Ethan in the audience, too, sitting with Jude and Thor. He looked grave, and something in her heart sank. She saw her father as well. He was sitting by himself, and he smiled at her each time he caught her looking his way. But when he didn't notice her watching him, he looked irritated, even upset. At length, the evening came to an end. Her father came up to kiss her and congratulate them all. He was quick to leave, though, which disturbed Charlie, especially since she still needed to talk to him alone. She left the dining room with Ethan and the others, pausing to look back at Ellsworth Daru. He saluted her with a nod, as if promising that he would be there for her if and when she needed him. It was late, so they all said goodnight and headed for their cabins. Ethan seemed preoccupied as they got ready for bed. He didn't ask her about the ship's long-dead doctor, though she was sure he must have seen Daru and all the rest of the ghosts. She didn't say anything, not that she wanted to lie, but because she wanted to talk to her father first. Instead, she asked him about the animal shelter.
Thor's gonna get a new husky.
Well, he is an Alaskan, and I think Clara told me they already have one husky, his dog that he brought with him when he moved down to crew headquarters, she said. What else?
He looked at her.
The head of Doggone It, Mr. Hayworth, told me that both Corley and Hickory were passionate about something going on at St. Energy. Apparently, the two of them were talking about a man they planned to ask to set up a meeting with one of the oil companies for him.
Who?
Your father.
She had no idea what to say, so all she could manage was,
Oh.
I talked to him. He said he knew there was talk about setting up some kind of meeting, but no one had approached him yet. He said he didn't even know that Albion and Farrell would be the two men doing the talking.
I'm sure he's telling the truth.
When he didn't respond, she let out a sigh and sank down on the bed.
So I have something to share, she said.
What's that?
he asked as he shrugged out of his jacket, took his holster and gun from his waistband, and set them by the bed.
The doctor paid me a visit today,
she said softly. The ship's doctor? He asked.
Yes. His name is Captain Ellsworth Drew, she said. He thought both Farrell and Albion were good men, and he adores my father. He saw people talking and arguing with Corley. Saw them, even. And he actually heard Albion and Farrell talking about a situation and saying they wanted to talk to my father.
I see.
No, you don't see. They died before they could talk to him. Damn it, Ethan, my father is not a murderer.
No, I don't believe he is, but he has held back important information.
What did he hold back that would have changed anything? Yes, Farrell Hickory was going to marry Shelley Corley, and he kept that confidence, but it doesn't matter. No one involved in the investigation believes that it was a hate crime.
That's true. But the way an investigation works, you often have to find out what things weren't before you can find out what they were. If your father had just been open about what he knew...
Your friend Laurent might have arrested him, Charlie snapped.
Charlie, I don't want to fight about your father.
Then quit acting as if he's a criminal.
He let out an explosive sound, finished taking off his shirt, and walked over to check the door and turn out the lights. She didn't move. When he slid into the bed to join her, she said,
My father is not a criminal.
Charlie, I'm not treating him like a criminal. I'm just trying to find out everything he knows. She fell silent, and for a few minutes neither of them moved, neither of them spoke. Then she scooted toward him and curled up on his chest and said,
Want to hear something great my father taught me when I asked him why he and my mom never seemed to fight? Might be cliched, and I'm sure you've heard similar, but it's all so true.
What? He asked her.
My dad told me that he and my mom never went to bed angry.
He can be a very sage man, Ethan said. And then he took her into his arms. For a while, the world was sensation, the scent and feel of him, the wonder of making love with someone you truly loved. But then she lay in the darkness again. Even held by him, even close, she was worried, and she knew the worry would stay with her until they discovered the truth.
Vicksburg, Mississippi, Jonathan said. All of you heading to the National Military Park with me, let's talk about Vicksburg. Vicksburg is the key. Who knows who said that?
He asked the group.
President Lincoln?
A teen asked.
Bingo! And do you know what President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy had to say?
Jonathan asked.
Something like up yours?
Another teen asked.
He might have thought it, Jonathan said, smiling. But what Davis actually said was, Vicksburg is the nailhead that holds the South's two halves together. So you can see that for both presidents, the Vicksburg campaign was one of the most important in the war. The siege of Vicksburg lasted from May 18th to July the 4th of 1863. It was the last major stronghold of the Confederacy on the Mississippi River. Of course, something else was going on at the same time. Anyone know what else happened from July 1st through the 3rd in 1863?
Gettysburg!
Several people called out simultaneously.
Exactly. So, the 4th of July, Independence Day, proved to be a pretty good day for President Lincoln, wouldn't you say?
There was a chorus of agreement. Jonathan went on to talk about logistics and how the campaign was part of the Anaconda plan to put a stranglehold on the Confederacy. Ethan stood with Jude and watched until Jonathan, leading scores of passengers, headed off to board the buses that would take them to the National Military Park. Thor was staying on the boat with the Bells, leaving Jude to accompany Ethan today.
You want to drive?
Jude asked now. Don't care. We both know the way around here, Ethan said.
I'll drive. You seem pissed off. Not a great mood for getting behind the wheel.
In the car, Jude said,
I just don't believe Jonathan Moreau is guilty.
I don't believe it either, Ethan said. I know the man and he isn't a killer. What I don't understand is why he hasn't been more forthcoming. He knew about Shelley. He knew at least something of what Corley and Hickory were up to. Selma Rodriguez was almost certainly killed because of something she knew, and she knew Corley was going to see Jonathan.
Careful. It sounds like you're laying her death at Jonathan's feet.
Jude said shrewdly. I'm not. I believe the killer thought she knew more than that. Corley was going to meet with Jonathan. That's not a reason to kill. There has to be more. Perhaps the killer thought Selma knew why Corley wanted the meeting.
Let's hope we can find out, Jude said.
The Sane Energy office was small, nothing like the sprawling property belonging to Doggone It. Of course, they didn't need that much space either. They saw a man seated at a desk when they entered. He quickly rose, sized them up, and smiled.
Hello! Welcome,
he said with a definite Mississippi accent, deep and rich and rolling.
I assume you're Special Agents Delaney and McCoy? I received a call from your office yesterday, so I made a point of being here today. I'm Frank Lorenzo, President, though I'm not sure how much the title means. We're an all-volunteer organization, and I'm usually at work at this time, but under the circumstances, I'm happy to miss a day work. How can I help you?
We'd like to understand what was going on, what Mr. Corley and Mr. Hickory were so upset about, Ethan said.
Gideon Oil,
Lorenzo said flatly and firmly.
They're laying an oil pipeline along the Mississippi. The states are in on it, Louisiana and Mississippi, that is. They've given their approval. But we've had engineers create models that show that there's an alternative, a safer alternative. The hitch is our alternative plan is more expensive, so their shareholders won't make their fortune as quickly as they were promised. Here, let me show you.
He led them to the back of the office, where several 3D models had been set up.
Construction will take longer, and the equipment will be pricier, so you're looking at more money for sure. But we think we have a good argument for long-term benefits, with no downside. So in the end, the payout to the shareholders will be higher. Setting up a meeting has been next to impossible, however. Well, they're constantly putting us off. A lot of us have been talking about what we should do, but Albion and Farrell, they were rabid on the subject. They were ready to take it to both state legislatures. And I believe,
Lorenzo said, meeting their eyes,
that they might have succeeded in getting the pipeline stopped and our plan instituted.
Why didn't you inform the authorities about this? Ethan asked. This could be motive for murder.
Lorenzo appeared to be truly perplexed.
Well, for one thing, they hadn't done anything yet, and playing hardball was their last resort. They believed they had the right man to try to set up friendly negotiations with Gideon Oil. Anyway, from what I've heard, their deaths had something to do with the Civil War reenactment they were in.
We're investigating every angle, Mr. Lorenzo, Jude said.
I had no idea I'd have anything at all helpful to say. Not until I got that call from Agent Hawkins yesterday, saying you'd be in and asking me to give you any information I could,
Lorenzo said. He seemed to be growing defensive. That wasn't going to help.
Mr. Lorenzo, we're not accusing you of anything, and we're very grateful you took the time to see us today, Ethan said.
The man appeared to be somewhat mollified.
Can you give us the names of anyone at Gideon Oil who might have been involved in the negotiations?
Jude asked. Lorenzo shook his head.
That's just it. We hadn't even talked to anyone yet. Albion and Farrell were going to talk to Jonathan Moreau about opening negotiations with Gideon Oil. Everyone respects him, and no one doubts his knowledge of and respect for the South, which makes everyone willing to listen to him. But it never got that far, because they never talked to him. You know, I talked to both Farrell and Albion.
He paused, as if he'd lost his breath for a minute.
I talked to them both before they were killed. Awful. One dead the first day, and not a day later the second.
I don't suppose you have the name of the CEO of Gideon Oil? Save us looking it up,
Jude said. Lorenzo laughed dryly.
Sure. Gideon. Saul Gideon. His family's been Big Oil forever.
They spoke for a few moments longer. Lorenzo gave them copies of his files on Gideon Oil and the River Project. They studied the models again, and then it was time to leave. When they were driving back, Jude looked over at Ethan and said,
There's one thing that argues against the murders being tied to the whole Sane Energy Gideon Oil situation.
I can think of two, actually. First, the fact that they hadn't even begun setting up negotiations, and second, the fact that the deaths of two men wouldn't really change anything,
Ethan said.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about something else, too, Ethan said. As in, why were the two of them dressed up in their uniforms, if their plan was to meet up with Moreau to ask him about being a negotiator?
It would make more sense to think they had a date with that photographer, Chance Morgan,
Jude said.
Except he had an alibi.
Kind of brings you back to the movie, people,
Ethan said.
Which brings us back to what the hell motive could any of them have to kill those two men, much less Selma Rodriguez, unless we are back to a hate crime.
I just don't see it. But we can find out from Gideon Oil if any overtures were made toward them. Maybe something they didn't know about at Sane Energy,
Ethan said.
Greed. Always a motive for murder.
Call Jackson. Ask him to ask Angela to look into what's going on at Gideon Oil.
I'm on it.
And tomorrow the journey's back in St. Francisville. At the very least, we'll have a chance to drop in on the movie set again.
That night, Ethan didn't come to either show, leaving Charlie to worry about what was going on. Thor, Jude, Alexi, and Clara all walked with her to her door, saw her safely inside, then separated and headed to their own cabins. Ethan was waiting for her in the room, pictures spread out on the bed. Charlie walked over to where he sat studying them. She saw, with a shock, that they were photos of the entire cast and crew of Brad's movie. Only her own picture was missing.
No luck at Gideon Oil?
She asked him.
He looked up at her. No. Are we feeling frustrated?
Yes. HQ's working on finding out if any private communications were exchanged between Gideon and Sane Energy.
And your focus back on the movie crew?
People don't usually dress up in Civil War uniforms to meet up with oil barons.
Charlie perched on the edge of the bed.
That's true, but...
Her voice trailed off as she heard that strange brushing sound at the door again. She raced over to open it, but Ethan was there in a flash, stopping her with her hand on the knob.
Charlie, you can't just open the door.
It's him, Captain DeRue,
she explained.
You have a ghost that knocks?
He's a Southern boy. He would never just walk into a woman's room.
Nevertheless, Ethan put his body between her and the door, then looked through the peephole to see the ghost.
Come in, he said, finally opening the door.
Captain DeRue, this is Ethan Delaney,
Charlie said as the ghost entered.
Ethan works for the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Ethan, Captain DeRue. He died of disease while tending to both Union and Confederate soldiers.
Captain DeRue nodded.
Mr. Delaney,
he said, his husky voice low but still clearly audible.
Captain, thank you for your help, Ethan said.
I wish that I could do more,
the captain said, staring intently at Ethan.
You might be a descendant of my cousin, sir.
Your cousin? Ethan said. Captain DeRue nodded.
We were torn apart, sir, by the travails of the war. My mother's sister married in St. Francisville, while my own mother married a man from Boston. For many years, my cousin and I saw one another frequently. Both our fathers were military men. They fought together in Mexico. But then South Carolina seceded from the Union and the war began. He went with his state, and I went with mine. We met again here, in the bloody hell of shelling that went on during the Port Hudson campaign.
Anson McKee, Ethan said. He was your cousin, wasn't he? The captain nodded.
Yes, and you look just like him.
He does, Charlie agreed. The captain turned sharply to look at her.
You've seen Anson.
We've both seen him, Ethan said. He's there by Grace Church outside St. Francisville. He's helped us several times.
He saved my life, Charlie told him.
What I wouldn't give to see Anson,
DeRue said. We'll be in St. Francisville tomorrow, but the journey stops there every week, Charlie said.
I haven't stepped off the ship since I died aboard her,
Captain DeRue said softly.
You must. Come with us tomorrow. I'm sure we can find him, Charlie said enthusiastically.
I can't leave the men,
the captain said.
They were entrusted to my care.
And they'll be fine if you leave them for just a little while, Charlie said.
The captain nodded, then glanced toward the bed. He saw the pictures there and walked over to look down at them.
Her,
he said, pointing to the shot of Jenny McPherson.
She's the one I told you about yesterday. She was arguing with Albion, and then...
He paused and turned to Charlie.
Then she went to speak with your father. I had forgotten that.
Ethan and Charlie looked at each other quickly. Charlie had wondered if the argument had been with Nancy and Todd Camp. Captain DeRue looked at the pictures again.
Yes, many of these people were here. I remember all of these men,
he said, and pointed to the pictures of Jimmy Smith, Luke Mayfield, Barry Seymour, and George Gonzalez.
I remember them all.
He straightened.
It has grown late. I will leave you to sleep. But I would be most grateful if I might accompany you ashore tomorrow.
Of course, Ethan said. We'll be with friends, but they're all safe. They've seen you just as Charlie and I have. Captain DeRue nodded.
I have seen them, I think. And I have noticed that they can see me and the men. Thank you, and good evening.
He saluted and turned. Once again, he didn't bother with the door, but simply vanished.
Jenny's name does keep coming up,
Charlie said.
But she's not even from St. Francisville. Plus, she's all of 5 feet and 90 pounds. I can't see her lifting an Enfield or wielding a bayonet, even if I could think of why she'd want to.
It'll all make sense, somehow, Ethan murmured. We'll find out tomorrow. For now,
he stopped, shrugged, and quickly cleared the photos off the bed, then smiled at her.
Time for bed, so we can make an early start in the morning.
She was surprised when he swept her into his arms.
Seize the night. That's what they say, isn't it?
Seize the night,
she agreed. And so they did, letting Charlie forget, at least for a little while, how much she was dreading tomorrow and the possible discovery that one of her friends was a killer. The plan was that they would all go ashore in St. Francisville. Alexei wasn't worried that they wouldn't have a chance to rehearse. They already had a set list and knew all the songs well, so they would be fine. Jude and Thor were going to go talk to Randy Laurent, who was expecting them. He was glum, having talked to half the people in town without discovering anything new. Jackson Crowe had contacted the CEO of Gideon Oil, Saul Gideon, and he had agreed to meet with them at his office in Baton Rouge the following day, although he'd made a point of saying he wasn't sure what help he could possibly give them. He'd said he hadn't even been approached by anyone from Sane Energy, but would have had no problem considering a new plan. And since he owned 51% of the company, the final decision on which method to go with would have been his. They hadn't spoken with Jonathan yet. Ethan had purposely delayed that morning, so by the time he and Charlie were ready to head ashore, Jonathan and his tour group were already gone. He wanted to observe Jonathan in St. Francisville. In fact, he was hoping to get Jonathan onto the film set, which might be possible since he would be talking at Grace Episcopal Church, and it shouldn't be too hard to sidetrack him afterward. Alexei and Clara were going to hang out at Mrs. Mama's cafe. It was public and safe, and they just might overhear something useful. The six of them met on deck before heading ashore, but they waited until pretty much everyone who was leaving the ship for the day was gone. When the deck was virtually empty, they saw Captain Ellsworth Drew coming toward them. They nodded to acknowledge his presence, since talking to thin air would have looked suspicious to the few people who were still around. Drew was smiling broadly, and Ethan thought he was the happiest ghost he had ever encountered. If nothing else, Ethan imagined there weren't that many occasions when anyone acknowledged him at all, much less six people at one time. Once they were off the ship, they claimed their rental cars and split up. Captain Ellsworth Drew accompanied Ethan and Charlie as they headed toward the bluff by Grace Church, where the film crew were still working on some last rising ghost shots. They'd spent the last several days, while Charlie was unavailable, working with Harry Grayson, Blaine, Pica, and the ghosts, getting new angles on the climactic scene of the ghosts destroying the oil company exec and the crooked senator. Ethan thought it was ironic they were now looking into Gideon Oil's potential involvement in three real-life murders.
"This is a movie set?"
Captain Daru asked as they arrived. He was familiar with movies from his time on the ship, and was keenly interested not only in the filming itself, but in everything behind the scenes, the catering tent, the dressing rooms, and especially the crates of props, so many of which could have come directly from his own past.
"Yes, this is it," Charlie said.
"Interesting," Captain Daru said. "And the reenactors will be here?"
he asked.
"Many of them," Ethan assured him. "From here, we'll walk over to Grace Church and see if we can't find Anson McKee."
"Thank you."
His words were heartfelt. Charlie might have been gone for a month rather than only a few days. She was greeted so warmly by Brad, Mike, the crew, and the actors on call. Not only Blaine and Harry, but Jimmy and Grant Ferguson, who were also part of the rising scenes.
"Charlie, any chance you have time for one scene?" Brad asked her. "Your costume's here, and I just want to shoot you getting up after the ghosts have saved you, over by the old graves on this side of the churchyard."
She glanced at Ethan. He nodded.
"Sure, we have a few hours," he said.
Ethan kept his eye on the dressing room while she changed, chatted with the other actors to pass the time.
"I'm so sick of being filthy," Jimmy said, "and people think an actor's life is all glamour."
"We do get to sit in the shade and sip mineral water," Grant said.
"Want to join us?" Jimmy asked Ethan.
"No, I think I'll wander down to watch the filming," Ethan told them.
Have fun, Jimmy said cheerfully, heading for the catering tent. Charlie came out of the dressing room, transformed into a modern young professional in her office attire. Brad, Mike, Luke, hauling his microphones, headphones, and other equipment, and Jenny, makeup box in hand, walked with her over to the spot where Brad had chosen to shoot. Everyone but Charlie was completely unaware that they'd been joined by Captain Ellsworth Drew. From his vantage point, a short distance from the church, Ethan could see both the filming and Jonathan standing near the church and speaking to a crowd. He noticed that Jenny frequently looked over in Jonathan's direction. The filming went off without a hitch. There was nothing for Charlie to see as she got up from the ground where she'd fallen, but Brad painted the picture with words as she looked around her. She was terrified when she first saw the ghosts, but then she realized they were there to protect her, that they would save her from the evil living men who were chasing her. Once they'd captured a satisfactory take, Brad had Luke set up a new scene marker and called for silence on the set. Charlie had been set up with a mic, and now she thanked the ghosts who were supposedly surrounding her, though once again she was on her own, talking to the air. When the scene was completed to Brad's satisfaction, he called, "Cut!" and went over and kissed Charlie on the cheek and told her she was brilliant. While Charlie was busy talking with Brad, Ethan strolled over to where Jenny was standing.